On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
So quite a lot in this morning's Sunday papers to get through with our panel, Jim McGrath and Ilona Duffy. Lots of coverage, first of all, on the prospect of a vaccine. So let's listen back, first of all, to a little bit of what Taoiseach Micheál Martin had to say to me when I sat down with him on Virgin Media News on Friday about the prospects of a vaccine being rolled out in the near future.
The vaccine is important, and I think the European President of the Commission is now saying that it could be the second half of December that they will get authorization, the Pfizer's and BioNTech and Moderna, which could mean for the early part of 2021 we're in a position to start procuring the vaccine. And I set up a high-level task force to go through the logistics of this, because this will be a very big operation logistically in the country. It could change the situation significantly for the better. And I think, look, it's hope. And the vaccine, I think, should, rather than be taking it as perhaps a time to let off and take it easy, I would look at it in reverse and say, you know, another while now, if we keep at this, the vaccine will come on stream and we're in a position to be in a much better society as a result of that.
Micheál Martin speaking to me on Virgin Media News on Friday evening, saying that the onset of a vaccine is perhaps the reason why compliance with the level 5 obligations have slowed down in the last couple of weeks, and he says perhaps it's a reason to knuckle down until that vaccine gets on stream. Let's talk to our newspaper panel this morning. As I mentioned, Ilona Duffy, who's a GP and head of the North East Doctor on Call Service, is with us. We're also joined by Jim McGrath, who's a former political advisor. He's now the commercial director of the Irish Pharmaceutical and Healthcare Association. And Jim, I suppose the pharmaceutical sector is a sector which doesn't always have the glossiest of reputations, but the fact that such a vaccine has been turned around in such novel circumstances so quickly is certainly good news for you and your sector, isn't it?
Absolutely, but it's not so much about our sector. I mean, society needs this vaccine, so the pharmaceutical sector, I think it's its moment to step up and step forward and try and fill this vital gap in our public health need. I suppose it's important to say, like, with the exception probably of clean water, you know, vaccine is one of the most successful and cost-effective public health interventions ever. But the context of it right now is what we're seeing is our political system is talking quite confidently about a vaccine, yet the filing for regulatory approval only happened actually last Friday. Mm. So as we're talking now in a legal and technical sense, the vaccine does not exist yet. Mm. What we have seen is the data from the trials leading up to that vaccine are pointing in a very positive direction. But I think it's important to note the logistical exercise and the investment in bringing a vaccine forward is costing billions. It's necessary at this moment in time. And I think we do have to just be careful, because the major logistical exercise to get a vaccine from production, from regulation, production, and out into the population is very significant. It can be done, and the confidence is growing and rising all the time. But it's certainly not going to be a smooth process. And I think it creates the right type of cooperation between regulators, politicians, and the pharmaceutical industry is needed. And we're pretty confident that that will happen.
Well, definitely the logistical concerns, particularly for the Pfizer one, because it has to be stored at such low temperatures for such a sustained period of time. It's obviously a massive logistical challenge. And that's why there is a high level task force. You mentioned there that, you know, so far we've only really heard from the pharmaceutical companies themselves. And although what they're saying is quite positive, should we perhaps be a little bit more guarded because of the fact that some of their own declarations haven't been subject to peer review, that this is, you know, science by press release rather than science by actual blind trials, you know, supervised by other people?
No, what is true is that our medical authorities haven't, as yet, they only received the application on Friday, so haven't verified any of this data. But all that has happened so far is the information from clinical trials has been released, and that's pretty normal and for the course. But I think the more important moment is when the FDA in the United States and the European Medicines Authority, if and when they do give that approval, that is the time that the vaccine becomes a very real prospect. And that is the time for confidence to grow, number one, and for public information exercises to kick in about how and what you might, what is needed to actually get this vaccine out into the community. Mm. So yeah, there is still a tale of caution, but what you're seeing and what the Taoiseach said there, I think why we're hearing that is our regulated, the data has been released from the companies via press release, correct? but our medical regulators are looking at the very same data, and they're briefing our government and politicians as to where they expect it to land. And it's clearly going in a positive trajectory. But you will note pharmaceutical companies are very restricted and won't ever talk about the specifics of a product until it actually comes on the market. And that's why the only information that you can put in the public domain at this point is the data from the clinical trials.
Sure. And obviously, as you say, we need to wait for the regulatory processes to run their course as well. And I think there's three days of talks with the FDA. Is it on December the 8th, 9th, and 10th? Is that right?
Correct. And I think it's at that moment that we can actually start to build public confidence in a vaccine. It's a very hard thing to do until such a time as our medical authorities have formally licensed and it has the stamp of approval from our medical authorities that says it's a clinical effective, it's cost effective, and it'll work in the community.
Alona Duffy, as I said, is also with us on the line this morning, a GP based in Monaghan and the head of the Northeast Doctor on Call Service. Alona, I'm sure you'd be delighted at the idea that the frontline healthcare workers, perhaps like yourself, would be at the front of the queue. But do you have any concerns, or what message would you have to people who may be concerned about how quickly this has all been arrived at? That ordinarily vaccines, you know, maybe they don't have as much political willpower behind them, but they take years and years to refine, and they don't just exist in a matter of months the way that this one has been found.
Well, I think it's great to hear Jim put out that message of having caution, because I think there is a sense that once this vaccine is delivered, that's it, everything will go completely back to normal and we have an end to this problem and COVID is gone forever. And as we know, that's not necessarily going to be the way, because there are going to be delays. Once it's approved, we then have to source the vaccine and we have to then decide how it's going to be distributed and who's going to get it. So it's going to take time. And also we have to remember that the studies on the vaccine and its efficacy will continue. I mean, my own sister is actually in London and she volunteered to be part of one of the trials and has had two injections to date, but that's going to continue. So she'll continue having blood tests on and on into the future, because I mean, our concern is we know that those people who got COVID, we still don't know how long their immunity lasts. So similarly with the vaccine, we're going to have to wait and see how long it will last. Will this virus mutate? Will the vaccine continue to provide cover for those who have been vaccinated? So there's still going to be lots of learning, and it won't be quite the, you know, the escape from the COVID life just with immediate effect. There are going to be problems, obviously, how we're going to deliver it. As you said, Gavin, there are issues. Some of the vaccines have to be stored at up to minus 80 degrees, and how that's going to allow us to deliver them. I don't think it's going to be as easy to deliver them in general practice. Some of the vaccines can be stored for a day or two. The initial one that came out, we were told 80 degrees, but 24 hours, that it didn't have to be at that. So that would allow it to be warmed up, I suppose, for delivery and everything. Some of the others can be up to 3 or 4 days at a warmer temperature, kind of a normal fridge temperature. But the reality is that's going to create difficulties in how we're going to administer this vaccine, and so there's a lot of work to be done on this yet.
Of course, it is worth noting as well that not necessarily all vaccine candidates need to be treated at the same temperature. I know the Moderna one, which was announced last week, is having 94.5% accuracy or effectiveness. That one doesn't have to be refrigerated quite so low. Jim, to what degree or to any extent do the pharmaceutical industry have any input in this new expert task force that's being rolled out, where they'll have some sort of input into how the logistical operation of all of this is going to work, and to make sure that they are, you know, that enough of these vaccines are actually manufactured at enough scale to get to all the people who need them?
Yeah, it's been very informal so far, but that's fine. I think the state needs to make a number of its own policy decisions prior to engaging with the industry. And I would have to say, you know, following Brexit and a number of other initiatives, that, you know, the pharmaceutical industry and the state do have quite a strong collaborative working relationship. So I would be very confident that they will ask for our input as and when they feel they need it. I just want to maybe reiterate a really important thing to the previous conversation. No pharma company will really put this product forward without its safety being absolutely and fully verified and verified independently. So when we talk about some of the difficulties that they will, and they are very real, very real. But safety will be absolute paramount to every pharma company. And I think it's on that basis that we will engage with the state as and when is needed. The vaccine task force, as far as I'm aware, is only just up and running, and I have no doubt that before they finish their work, there will be some engagement with the pharmaceutical industry, and we do stand by ready and when that happens, but it's not unusual. I think there's a lot of policy work the state would have to do in advance of that anyway.
Just worth pointing out as well, one tweeter has gotten in touch already to say that according to Luke O'Neill, who was speaking on this station, of course, earlier in the week, the vaccines for COVID, they're not necessarily coming from a standing start. They are, of course, building on existing technologies that have been tried for some cancer vaccines. So perhaps that might explain or might assuage people who have some concerns around how quickly these could be potentially coming to market. In terms of timing, let's just hear a little bit about what the UK Health Secretary Matt Hancock had to say when he was speaking about this on Friday.
What I can say about timing is that if, and it still is an if the regulator approves a vaccine, we will be ready to start the vaccination next month with the bulk of the rollout in the new year. We're heading in the right direction, but there is still a long way to go. Coronavirus remains a grave danger right now. So we must all keep doing the things that we know blunt the force of this lethal virus. Hands, face, and space. And if you have symptoms, get a test. And help keep everyone safe until the science can help to see us through to the other side.
So that's what the UK Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, was saying when he was talking about the rollout of a COVID-19 vaccine on Friday. Alona, what's striking there is that Matt Hancock is intimating that the UK's GPs are already fully part and parcel of the process. They're signed up to help deliver this. I get the suspicion that maybe, although Irish GPs might be on board in principle, that very little has been done to get GPs on board in practice for the delivery of a vaccine yet.
Well, as far as I know, there's been no meaningful negotiation with the GPs and discussions on how this is to be done. And that's not to say we're not going to support the rollout of this vaccine. We have helped roll out all vaccine programs to date, including the normal flu vaccine. And also, you know, we were kind of landed with the childhood flu vaccine, which has been a bit of a disappointing kind of process because we just haven't had the uptake. So I think what we've got to do is we've got to see how are we going to do this. So again, obviously we've talked about issues like how the vaccine's got to be stored, but also how are we going to give it? I mean, GPs are all reporting that they're just so busy. They're busy dealing with COVID presentations in an ongoing way, but also dealing with the normal routine day-to-day stuff. And wintertime is always our busy time. And every year we give out and we say we're so busy and patients give out saying they can't get timely appointments with us. So this is going to be a very time consuming process. We're going to have to talk to patients. There is talk that they will absolutely have to stay in the area for a minimum of 15 minutes to ensure that they have no adverse reaction to the vaccine. And obviously with us having to ensure, you know, distancing in our practices, that's not going to be easy. So I think we're going to have to look at other models for the delivery of this. And many GP practices tried this with the childhood vaccination program, running weekend clinics, setting up kind of drive-through clinics, having marquees as we did in our own practice. And it kind of was new and it was different and it was hugely time consuming. So I think we're going to need a bit more support and we're going to need the infrastructure of the HSE in kind of helping us get involved in this. And simple things like our indemnity will have to be covered, all kinds of issues like that just to get things going.
Yeah, indemnity is a whole other issue as well. And we could spend ages talking about it. But just before I go to a break, you probably have seen the piece in today's Business Post by Elaine Byrne, who was talking about how the important thing now is to make sure that there is wider uptake of a vaccine, that we know herd immunity only really works if about 70% of people have adopted a vaccine, and perhaps there is reason to worry that maybe it won't get the same uptake as we need.
Well, I think we already battled that when we look at our ordinary annual flu vaccination. This year, we've had unprecedented demand for it and we just haven't had the vaccines to meet that demand. But if you look at one group, even our healthcare workers, those who work in hospital settings and other healthcare professionals, to date, there's been a really, you know, not good enough uptake of the annual flu vaccination. This year, we know that it's been reported that that is much higher. But are we going to face the same kind of reluctance to go for this vaccine amongst them? So if we're having difficulties with that group, how are we going to kind of get the support of the general population? And are we going to kind of doing a kind of a carrot or a stick thing? Are we going to be telling people you must have this vaccine? Or are we going to be saying, well, by having this vaccine, perhaps it gives you an immunity passport? So there will be ways of doing things as have been done with other vaccines in other countries.
In your own experience, just before I go to the break, how has the uptake of the flu vaccine been for under 12s? Because I know that it's supposed to be free and that it's non-invasive. It's like a nasal squirt, but that there's some reports from some GPs who are finding it very difficult to get children to take that up.
We're finding it very difficult to get the take up. And I think probably it's new. And while it's been advertised kind of in, most practices have done their own bit, sending out text to patients, parents. I think just the ease of giving it has just been difficult. Parents have kind of gotten used to a lot of the vaccines in the school going age being done through the schools. And unfortunately, that hasn't been done here. In the UK, this flu vaccine has been given for years through the school process. And I think that makes it easier because parents aren't having to take time off. There are less kind of barriers in the way of giving this. And again, that's probably the way this should have been done. And my concern is that we're going to have lots of these childhood flu vaccinations left. They go out of date in the middle of January, so we need to be doing something to ensure that we haven't wasted millions and millions, and also that we haven't left these children unprotected and against the flu when we have this vaccine ready to go.
Jim, just one final note about rollout and logistics. Assuming all goes well, knowing that Pfizer, I think, only intended to manufacture 100 million doses of their own candidate this year, the billions come next year, how early do you think in all likelihood we could have actual delivery of the first working COVID-19 vaccines in Ireland?
Very hard for me to know. However, I do think that, when we find a successful candidate, the truth is even you may only have one or two initial pharma companies with a vaccine. The truth is probably multiple pharma companies will manufacture that same vaccine. So the entire sector will likely mobilize when we have a vaccine candidate. I have no insight into that, but I would only point to the politicians in the UK and in Europe, and even the Taoiseach Micheál Martin, are talking about availability in Q2 next year. But they're obviously, somebody has to make a decision around the policy priorities of who gets the first dose, which obviously the vulnerable people, healthcare workers, are the likely first candidates, and then setting up the logistics of that. So I think, Gavin, there's quite a long road to go, but the signs are that it is a positive one.
Yeah, it's interesting that the European leaders seem to be talking about Q2 of next year when Matt Hancock is already talking about at least having some, albeit very limited, rollout, of course, in the UK next month. We'll wait and see what happens, but in the meantime, we have to get through Christmas. So what exactly should we expect from Christmas 2020 when it comes to COVID restrictions? We'll talk about those with Jim and Ilona next.
I want once again to unreservedly apologise for my lapse of judgment.
It was an error of judgment which I deeply regret.
So hands up, and I'd like to take this opportunity to apologise for my lack of judgment.
Some of the apologies from Eileen Dunn, David McCullough and Brian Dobson there about their participation at a little shindig for a send-off for an RTE receptionist earlier in the week, pictures of which of course have been dominating some media coverage in the last couple of days. Miriam O'Callaghan too has added her apology this morning. She said, as someone who is in the public eye, it is important to lead by example. She let everyone down, she says, and for that I will be forever sorry. We will touch on that a little bit later this hour here on The Record on News Talk. Gavin Riley with you this morning, just coming up to 11:30, but in the meantime we're going to talk about the sort of Christmas that we're looking forward to. I'm joined on the line by Jim McGrath and Ilona Duffy. And Ilona, in particular, there is obviously an awful lot of stuff written in today's papers speculating about what sort of Christmas it will be, what sort of hospitality there will be, a bit touching on what sort of travel there will be. But your eye was already taken by an editorial in the Sunday Times. It just talks about how, you know, the government has so many more concerns other than health. There's the economy, the fact that even Dublin Zoo is on the brink of closure is an illustration of how many different factors the government has to take in. You're upset with this editorial. Why is that?
Well, I'm kind of, even the title Medical Hierarchy Must Not Be Allowed Usurp Cabinet, I kind of have to say it's quite an inflammatory article, and really more or less saying that, you know, medics on the NPHET team are out of touch, and, you know, talks about finger wagging mode and, you know, more or less kind of saying that these doctors don't seem to care about the public and they don't seem to care about the country, whereas this is completely the opposite. So I suppose if we take it back and kind of imagine that this is your doctor giving you advice about a course of treatment that you require, but that management, let's say it's in a hospital, are basically have to ultimately make the decision on funding this or not. And you're being told you need this treatment, you need this treatment. But, you know, the decisions that are being made by managerial, and I'm not kind of blaming in any way management, are saying, well, we can't because we need this funding for other things and we've got to think about the greater good. But this treatment is required for you. So it's a bit similar to this. They're there to advocate for the patient. And the patient in this stage, all the NPHET doctors are there. We are the patients. We are the people they are trying to protect from COVID. So their duty of care is to advise on that. It is not to talk talk about the cost of the treatment or to decide whether, you know, giving you that means that somebody else doesn't get something else. They're treating you as a person.
And all of that is fair enough, Ilona, but at the same time, when it comes to NPHET, and this isn't meant as a criticism of NPHET, it's the way it's designed, but NPHET's concern is not, you know, whether state exams could have been run safely, or NPHET's concern isn't the state of public enterprise. NPHET's concern naturally is public health. So it's understandable that the government would take that and then, you know, consider other parallel concerns alongside it as well, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. No, and NPHET aren't the ones making the decisions. Ultimately, it is the government. But I think when you look, you know, NPHET are looking at the figures. And there's another excellent article in the Sunday Independent, and Maeve Sheehan talks about why are outbreaks still happening. And it's really interesting to look at it. There's a breakdown of the clusters that have happened over 14 days of level five, the week ending October 31st and the week ending November 14th. And there's a rise from in between those two dates from 480 clusters to 1,057. Clusters. And where are the bulk of these? They're in homes. The initial group ending October 31st, private homes were 320, accounted for 320 of the cases involved in that. But by the week ending the 14th of November, we're up to 954. So what is this indicating? This is indicating we're seeing more spread amongst groups in homes. We're seeing probably that indicating that people are meeting more. And that's while we're not meant to be meeting. So if and when things open up, because the reality is we know things will open up for Christmas. It's going to happen, absolutely. But I think what they're trying to say is we have to also understand when things open up, that's going to mean a spread of the virus in those groups. And if we can't get the overall levels to a really low rate, we're going to see a massive resurgence of this. And by the end of January, we will see rates probably in the thousands. That's the stats that are there and that have been proven before when we've started to see it rise. Because, you know, it takes a fortnight to start seeing things because of the incubation time. But once it starts going up, it's very hard to control it. And it takes weeks and weeks to do that again.
The one thing that really struck me by that breakdown that you mentioned on page 12 of the Sunday Independent that Maeve Sheehan has produced, the figures from the HPSC that private houses, as you said, for the week ending November 14th, 954 clusters in private houses. And of course, that's understandable because if one person brings it home, they are very likely to give it to someone else. But the question is, where are they getting it? And maybe you wonder, and this is only just a, you know, a hunch or a gut estimate, a guesstimate, but maybe it was something to do with the celebration of Halloween, because these clusters would have broken out about 2 weeks after people would have had a bank holiday weekend and maybe enjoyed some Halloween festivities which they thought were safe but perhaps weren't.
Absolutely. And I think it's getting that message across. And NPHET have changed even the way they're sharing the information. They're giving us more real kind of, you know, relatable information. It's not just the figures. They're telling us how easy it is for somebody maybe coming from abroad who doesn't restrict their movements and who is positive, or somebody who is symptomatic and delays in reporting those symptoms and getting tested and going into isolation, or somebody who is who has been in close contact with a positive case, failing to isolate for the full 14 days. They're the real kind of scenarios and stories we need to hear so that we understand how important it is to continue to you know, report. And you mentioned it earlier, the importance of reporting your symptoms early on. Like last week, in one day, I had people onto me. I was on call that evening as well, and people ringing about cough in their children, cough on themselves that they'd had for days, and they continue to go to work and continue to go to school. Like, that's just unacceptable. And I think even in this article as well, and Dr. Ian Quintile, who would be the public health specialist in our area, is talking about some of the scenarios, including one where he rang somebody to tell them, to talk to them about them being positive, and they were actually using their 14 days at that stage it was 14 days obviously isolation time to go abroad. So, you know, this just shows we, you know, people still perhaps are just that little bit lax, not understanding how important this is. And again, perhaps because they're kind of thinking it won't hit me, it won't affect me. But back to the Christmas scenario, I mean, we all want to be able to spend time with family. And I think people want to be able to travel to another, maybe move back home from Dublin to wherever they're from, et cetera, et cetera. They want to be able to do that. And we have to be able to ensure that we can do that safely. And the way of doing that safely is to try and get the levels down as low as possible in the weeks leading up to Christmas. And that's probably going to mean, you know, maintaining some level of restrictions there. I think we obviously all of us, you know, apart from anything, we all want to see some opening up of shops and things. And again, if you look at the figures there, you know, retail outlets, one case and two case, that's it. So again, we can show that we can do things safely, but obviously it means people adhering to all those guidelines.
But of course, the number of clusters and retail outlets will be relatively small when, of course, retail outlets by and large haven't been open for the last couple of weeks. But one point that I wanted to make to you, Jim McGrath, and I'm reluctant of sounding like the Grinch who stole Christmas when I make a point like this, but you know, everyone is so focused now on what sort of regime they'll be, whether they'll be allowed to travel, how many visitors you might be allowed to have to a home at the same time. Everyone is understandably worried about those things. But I wonder, are we putting Christmas on too much of a pedestal? Because it's only a few months ago since all the concern was around people having visitors over and they have a couple of drinks and suddenly social distancing goes out the window and they sit a little bit too close together and that's where viruses break out. And I wonder if you allow any kind of travel home for Christmas, and I'd love to go and see my parents at home for Christmas. I haven't been there in months, my wife the same. But if you go home at Christmas and you start sitting close together and you have a couple of drinks and unbeknownst to you, one of you is already carrying the virus and you're asymptomatic, then is Christmas worth having in the way that we usually expect it, if it only is going to result in hundreds or thousands of new cases in January and unfortunately the deaths that follow?
I suppose the value we put on Christmas as a society kind of determines that, and that will determine what people's risk behavior is. And I think there's a lot of validity in the point you make. I do think we shouldn't underestimate, though, when it comes to NPHET and the government decision making. This is really high stakes, high pressure stuff that genuinely affects people's lives and their livelihoods. So kind of tensions between the medical and health mandate that NPHET have versus the broader mandate that government have are inevitable. Hugh O'Connell has a terrifically insightful piece on in the Sunday Independent as well, a spread detailing some of the tensions that are ongoing with that. And it certainly makes for very interesting reading. From my own view, though, you don't want to sit as much as possible to the public. You want to present a united front across everything. NPHET have their mandate, and that is to advise. Government have their broader mandate. But what Irish politicians, you can criticise them for many things, but given the nature of our political system, they are pretty close to our people and they understand where the public mood is at any given time and what people will and won't tolerate.
Sure, but of course people probably won't tolerate being told to keep away from each other at Christmas. And even in my interview on Friday night, Micheál Martin was intimating that some people's journeys home to their parents or family shouldn't be considered essential, and he asked people to reconsider. But if people are going to do that, then I suppose politicians are, it's lose-lose, because either you tell people not to go home for Christmas and you come across as a Grinch, or you allow people to go home knowing that it's going to result in more transmission of a virus that can kill some of the people it contacts.
Yeah, I think we're not going to defeat this virus by our politicians trying to be popular. However, I think our politicians would be a very good guide for what people will likely do and likely behave. And the value of any advice from NPHET is as valuable as the consent of society, of the behaviour that goes with that advice. So if NPHET are appearing to the political system as being too strict in some guise, you know, we can't have guards on every crossroads. Whatever the measure is, has to be backed up with community support. But obviously, in the community, people will want to interact with each other at Christmas. So then there's a call to be made. What's the right medical thing to do? What's people likely behaviour? And what's the appropriate balance between those two things? And I think just knowing what we are like as Irish people, I think people do want to follow the rules and won't take unnecessary risk. But it will be very difficult for people to stay completely detached from their loved ones at Christmas. So then it's a call, if we think society is going to go in that direction, regardless of what NPHET advises, then it comes to, well, how do we best manage that? But I don't think, and in fairness, the government, Micheál Martin, everyone else, the way to deal with this virus is to have strong leadership. And strong leadership is not always about being popular. The popular thing to do would be to say, do whatever you want, have socialize with whoever you want. And you might be very popular and might win re-election. But that's not the space we're in as a country.
Well, I certainly don't know how much. Ilona, very briefly, please.
I was just going to say, I mean, NPHET aren't talking about cancelling Christmas. NPHET are talking about having safe Christmas, which is get the numbers down low before Christmas. And then what we're going to have to do is have a public campaign on how to maintain a safe Christmas. You know, have windows open, try and not be in the same room for more than 2 hours. There are ways of reducing your risk of being a close contact. So we can do that. But again, NPHET aren't the ones talking about closing Christmas.
We need to make sure as well that there's adequate resourcing of contact tracing for the couple of days after Christmas as well, because that could be a very busy couple of weeks. Lots written about those in the papers. We'll wait and see exactly what comes from the government deliberations this coming week. We'll be talking more about the issues of housing and that shindig in RTE.
We did look for an interview with an RTE spokesperson about this event, but no one was available.
We did ask for a spokesperson from RTE and we were told that nobody was available.
We've asked RTE for a spokesperson and they declined. They don't feel they've anything to add to the statement.
I think those clips probably speak for themselves. RTE unable to find a spokesperson from their own organisation to take to their own airwaves in the last couple of days to speak about the events in the RTE reception a couple of days ago, when social distancing was not observed and masks not being worn as colleagues bade farewell to a retiring colleague. On that particular note, Jim McGrath, before we talk about the event itself or what it might mean, you could argue an awful lot about whether it is appropriate for a public service broadcaster not to put forward a spokesperson to discuss a reasonably legitimate story on their own airways. You'd argue that it maybe doesn't serve their own audience too well in not doing that.
Perhaps so. I think they clearly, you know, were trying to withdraw oxygen from the story, and partly on the basis that the presenters themselves were going to handle the apology on the show. For me, though, I think the whole thing kind of demonstrates that, you know, we can tell people to cop on and we can call people out for maybe they should be behaving better, but do we have to demonize everyone that kind of falls foul of the breaches of the guidelines every single time? But having said that, you know, the irony is not lost in terms of a media organization, particularly RTE, that, you know, on an editorial line might behave, you know, quite frenzy-like when it comes to things like Golfgate, yet maybe be not apply those same standards internally. So I do think there was a gap in the communication there. Not sure the reason RTE didn't choose to fill that in and of itself, and because RTE itself would be critical of other organisations that would do the same. So it was a bit surprising.
Yeah, the real issue, Ilona, perhaps is not really the events that happened at that particular retirement due. And again, I do feel very sorry for the person who was retiring, because then I find themselves in the newspapers for reasons which are really, really unfortunate. But maybe the damage is that politicians are those who are more inclined to argue for some sort of disobedience, or who disagree with there being COVID-19 restrictions in the first place, will feel justified in attacking RTE and other media outlets who try to have those upheld, because they'll believe that we are preaching things which we ourselves in the media are not observing.
Oh, I think you're right. I think it's you know, it's one of these things that just shows how easy it is to let your guard down. I'm sure all of these people are adhering to, you know, all the guidelines and every other aspect of their life. They're wearing masks out, they're limiting their, you know, other things. And then something like this happens and it seems like such a simple thing. It's clear they were all getting messages asking them to be there at this event. And why, you know, you also have to, it goes back to who organized the event too, who made a decision to have it, who made the decision to push people to come and didn't warn people or advise people, you know, when you're coming, make sure you're wearing a mask.
Yeah, isn't that probably that's the real issue about RTE not putting forward a spokesperson? Because the presenters can only answer for their own behavior, but the presenters didn't organize the event, if it was organized in that sense. That's why an RTE spokesperson really should have been out on it.
Well, I do think an RTE spokesman person should have been out on it. You're right, because, I mean, as you said, this unfortunately compromises all of these journalists, because now when they are being asked about issues and if something like Golfgate comes up again, it's going to be very hard for them to be challenging somebody on this when they can be challenged themselves. Although at the same stage, you know, it also means that they have a greater understanding of it, but it is disappointing. But again, I think if we can use it as a learning lesson, how easy it is to let your guard down, how easy it is to say, oh yeah, sure, that's only going to take a few minutes and we'll go along. And the reality is, actually, if they weren't close, you know, what is a close contact? 15 minutes together within the 2 meter period. So I suppose they may not have been that close together for that long.
Casual,
but the reality is,
they are,
you know, they are people with a public profile. They have a responsibility, therefore, because of that. And unfortunately, they let themselves down.
Yeah, interesting to see that the Oireachtas Media Committee says that it's now going to investigate this. I'm not sure really what extra stones it can propose to overturn, but we'll see exactly what they want to pursue with it in the meantime. There is one other issue in today's papers which is quite dominant, which I wanted particularly to speak to you about, Jim, because in your previous life you were a special advisor in the Department of Housing, as it is now known. There's a lot written about the decision this week of councillors in Dublin City Council to vote down a plan to turn over lands at Oscar Traynor for redevelopment, mostly by a private builder. What do you make of, first of all, the decision, but then secondly, of the coverage that surrounds it?
So as a couple of things, I'll make my comments in a more broader context. I think, Gavin, the decision that the city councillors arrived at is partly as a result of quite a poor conversation that we have when we debate all matters of housing in Ireland. The debate always tries to, I suppose, pit the public sector model versus the private sector model and developers and for-profit and various bits. The truth is that there are advantages and disadvantages to all our approaches to housing, and we would be much better served by recognising what the private sector is good at, what the private sector definitely can't do, what the public sector is good at, and what the public sector definitely can't do.
So the private sector is very good at building housing quicker than the state can probably do it, but the private sector is also very good at doing it more expensively than the state can do it.
Correct. Yeah, and that's exactly it. The private sector will only build for a profit. The private sector does own a good chunk of the land that could be used for residential development, and it's... and the private sector can build at much quicker speed, because a developer has to have a very different relationship with the local community that surrounds a potential housing development than a local authority has. However, the local authority or the state is probably one of the few ones that can build at rates that are kind of properly affordable, because we have actually added a number of costs to the building process which get applied to the cost of the house. These are building regulations, planning reforms, land prices, cost of finance. The public sector doesn't have those, but the public sector has a very different legal risk when it comes to tendering. It has to operate. It's a legal authority, so it has to operate by the law, which means it's can be excessively bureaucratic and take a long time, as it did in O'Devany Gardens, Oscar Traynor Road, and many others.
Can you understand, though, why councillors would be have natural concerns around any deal which involves a council taking land which a council already owns? It's already in the public employ. The state owns the land. Why it would agree to hand over that land to a private builder for free, allow a private builder to build some homes, and then keep half of those homes for itself to be able to sell on at a profit? You would go, well, why and under any circumstances would you hand over public land to be handed over for development for someone else's private gain?
Yeah, I absolutely do understand the concerns, but where I think we're not having a sensible debate nationally is leading to the decision that the councillors took was as a result of years of a planning process and a decision made in 2017, and all that could potentially be lost now. So the concerns are very valid, and there is a very valid concern that the developers might be excessively profiteering on the back of public lands, and that's valid. What we should try to do, though, is where is the appropriate accommodation for the public and private sector within these developments? Because, firstly, the expertise for large scale for residential development at that scale does not exist in our local authorities. They are not developers. Resourcing them to become developers can happen, but I think it would take decades to actually do that, because you wouldn't be, you see, it's not just that, you know, you could potentially hire expertise from the private sector to project manage these, but because the working parameters of a local authority are so different to a private developer, it would take, you know, the best developer from the private sector to come into Dublin City Council, it would take them a long time to get to grips with the working of a local authority. And there are certain things, like in the private sector, you know, you can have a very different approach to tendering, for example. You can, you know, oh, we're short a series of plumbers today, let's ring X and get them in. A public sector body has to write a tendering document, put it to the market, have it legally proofed, have all the legal advice squared away.
So
in every project of this type, the public sector is always going to be slower, but the private sector will be faster. But it doesn't necessarily mean it will do it at a price that is affordable to the most of the population,
which is
why you need these things to be mixed developments, and you need a more constructive conversation that we have, that it isn't one against the other and not one approach is superior to the other.
Okay,
what is the right balance and blend?
I'm sure that there are others, the likes of Ona Brin writing the Business Post today, who would disagree, but it's not an argument we have time to get into right now. Ilona, before we let you go, we did again mention it earlier, but perhaps as a public service it's maybe worth repeating or re-emphasising the importance and the availability of the flu vaccine. What do people and parents need to know about where they get it?
Okay, so the flu vaccine is available free to all children between the ages of 2 and 12. It's a nasal vaccine, so it's like a little squirt of water into both nostrils, so both sides of the nose. Pain-free, easy to get, and, you know, minimal side effects. We've actually had nobody ring us, and we've given hundreds of them. You contact your GP or your local pharmacy, and they will arrange time with you to give it to you. And what I'd say to you is get this done now. This is about keeping your children safe, but also reducing flu rates in our community, and therefore keeping our older and more vulnerable people who haven't managed to get a flu vaccine this year, because we've run really short of the injectable one for the older people.
Okay. Ilona Duffy, GP based in Monaghan, thanks very much for joining us this morning. She's also the head of the North East Doctor on Call Service. And Jim McGrath, who's a former political advisor. He's now the commercial director of the Irish Pharmaceutical and Healthcare Association. Thank you both for joining us this morning on News Talk.